Wayne, America's 100 leading metropolitan areas, and that includes Philadelphia and its suburbs, sit on just 12% of the country's land. While the geography is small, it's where most people live, and it generates 75% of the nation's GDP. Our guest Bruce Katz says that these regions are the future of this country and are becoming hubs of innovation and development. He's the co-author with Jennifer Bradley of a new book titled The Metropolitan Revolution, How Cities and Metros Are Fixing Our Broken Politics and Fragile Economy. The subtitle refers to the gridlock in Washington and the top-down form of government that the authors say has run its course. They write that the relationship between the federal government and state governments that has excluded metropolitan areas is anachronistic. Bruce Katz is the director of the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, it's great to be here.
So are we talking about city-states sort of half seceding from the rest of the country?
Well, to some extent, we are going back in time. You know, Jennifer and I obviously see a country that has some huge challenges in the aftermath of the recession, and for all intents and purposes, the federal government has left the building. It is mired in partisan rancor. The good news, however, is cities and metropolitan areas and the networks of leaders who govern them are stepping up and doing the hard work to grow jobs and make our economies more prosperous, investing in infrastructure, investing in manufacturing, equipping workers with the skills they need, helping to link small business with global markets, new opportunities. You know, our sense is for the foreseeable future, change is going to happen where people live. It's a wave of innovation. We think it could spread across the country, bring benefits to every metropolis.
But are we talking about evolution or revolution or some combination of the two?
I think it's a revolution in many respects because it changes how we think about our country. I mean, when, you know, go back to third grade, right? I mean, you look at your civic textbooks. The president, the vice president, 535 members of Congress sit on top of the system. They rain down resources. They rain down rules. They co-govern with the states, their constitutional partner. That's just not the way we operate anymore. The cities and metros, as you said really at the beginning, they are the engines of the economy, centers of trade and investment. And when you actually look at the indicators that really matter today, skilled workers, innovation like patents, infrastructure to move goods, services, energy, ideas, they're 75, 80, 85, 90% of the nation's share. There is no American economy. What we are is a network of metropolitan economies. We've got to change how we think about our country.
You use an interesting metaphor that the federal government, state governments, they're the adults, and the cities, the metro areas are the kids, I guess, sort of waiting for the allowance. But you also say it's not going to come. You kids have to figure this out on your own.
Yeah. Frankly, the cities and metros I go to, they're not waiting for Washington to become functional anytime soon, or frankly, Harrisburg or many state capitals. So what's happening, which is really quite interesting, are these networks of leaders are coming together. They're trying to understand, okay, what's the position of our metro in the global economy? What's our distinctive play, our special assets and advantages? Because every place is a little different. And then what's our game changer? L.A., Denver, investing in transit, really state-of-the-art modern transit. Houston, integrating immigrants. Portland, Oregon, becoming the trade capital of the world around sustainable products and sustainable services, given urbanization in China and India. Place after place after place are making some transformative bets. Some cost some real resources, public, private, civic. Some are actually fairly low cost. It's just this collaborate to compete phenomenon that's happening around the country.
And I do want to talk about all that and some of the good news. And I was telling our guests as we were preparing for this interview that it's been a long time since I read a book about the good news and politics and policy, but we will get to that. Just how dysfunctional, since you work at Brookings, just how dysfunctional is our federal government?
Yeah, it's quite alarming. And I worked in the federal government for 10 years. I worked 6 years in the U.S. Senate for wonderful people, Senator Cranston of California, Senator Sarbanes from Maryland, Senator Riegel from Michigan. And I was chief of staff at HUD, Department of Housing and Urban Development, for Henry Cisneros under President Clinton. I have never seen it like this before. It is total partisan gridlock in the Congress. And that's on the legislative side. In the executive branch, We've barely staffed the government in many of our cabinet agencies because it takes so long for people to get through the confirmation process. And frankly, a lot of people don't want to serve anymore, right, because of the rancor. So it's bad. It's real bad. But I think what we've discovered during this period is how powerful we are as a network of city and metropolitan economies. And frankly, there are whole ranges of things where the federal government matters and states matter, but the power is within our control and grasp.
So do we just forget about Washington and let them figure out what they're going to do? I mean, there's still a lot of money that comes from Washington to metropolitan areas, including here in Philadelphia and the region.
I think what we need to do is have a reality check as city and metropolitan leaders. What should Washington do first and foremost? They should do what we can't do as cities and metros. We're not going to run our own Medicare and Medicaid programs. We're not going to strike our own trade deals with China. We're not going to secure our food supply, right? There are things that national governments really need to do. But on everything else, and frankly, the stuff that really matters, education and skills, infrastructure, roads, transit, ports, airports, energy distribution. Mm. Cities and metros have a lot of skin in the game already. They finance a good portion of this stuff. And I think the days of thinking the cavalry is coming, they're over. We are essentially on our own. And if we set our own visions at the city and metropolitan scale, frankly, and there are great stories in the book, particularly out of Los Angeles,
right. The
federal and state governments will follow.
Well, I know you know Philadelphia pretty
yes.
well, but you do not profile this region in your book. And I do want to talk about some of the other regions that you do profile. But I think as someone who lives here, Philadelphia has many things going for it. It also has extremely high poverty rate and all the problems that come with
sure.
that. There have been efforts at regionalization, thinking regionally here, some more successful than others. I don't know whether this region is an outlier or slow to sort of sign on to this metropolitan thinking, or we're just muddling along like everybody else.
Well, you're somewhat emblematic, right? I mean, in the sense that the U.S., for a good portion of the country, has like a 13th century British model of government, right? I mean, just dozens and dozens, hundreds and hundreds of municipalities outside the large central city. And
everyone wanted to control the
everyone
police and schools
exactly,
and fire department and all
exactly.
that.
So the reality is the real unit in the global economy, particularly in a global economy when China's online and India's online and Brazil is online, is the metropolitan area. That's the labor market. That's the housing market. That's the commuter shed. What we talk about in the book, which I think is very instructive for Philadelphia, is the story of Denver. Go back 40 years, city and suburb at each other's throat because of school issues, because of race and ethnic divisions. But they come together bit by bit, people reaching out across jurisdictional and disciplinary lines. They make some smart bets on arts and culture. They then build a world-class airport. They now have the largest light rail system in the United States being financed primarily at the local level through sales taxes. That's what happens when different leaders collaborate to compete. There's a Metropolitan Mayor's Caucus. They meet on a regular basis. They don't love each other. But what they understand is for Denver, which is in the middle of nowhere to some extent, they need to have a brand and an image and an ability to project power on the global stage. They can only do that together.
But was there one person that thought this up, or was there a crisis that brought people together? What got them to do this?
The bottom dropped out in the 80s because of the energy crisis. They had good mayors. Mayor Pena, Mayor Webb, Mayor Hickenlooper, who's now the governor of Colorado. So good public leaders, but frankly, people you've never heard of. There's a guy named Tom Clark, who's been running the Economic Development Corporation at the metropolitan level. Really smart, focused, disciplined individual who understands, we've got to think about what really drives economies forward and how do we make the smart strategic investments, sustain them over time, and then brand and market ourselves to the world. Denver is a powerhouse today. It was not 30 years ago.
I was surprised to read about your description of the possibilities in Detroit.
And, sure.
And Detroit, I think, is often used as an example of a city that's almost a basket case because of the loss of the industrial economy there. You see something different.
Well, Detroit is a very large city. It's 138 square miles. You can throw Manhattan in there, San Francisco, Boston, and you'd still have room over.
Really?
Yeah.
That big?
Oh, it's very, very large. It used to be 2 million people, 1950. It's now down to below 700,000. But in the core of Detroit, let's say 7 square miles, by the Detroit River, Canada actually sits to the south, the downtown, the old Woodward Corridor, the Midtown. You've got Wayne State. You've got Henry Ford Health System, Detroit Medical Campus. You've got the College for Creative Studies. You've got some really interesting possibilities around tech and creative and small batch manufacturing, and it's happening. It's not government that's fueling this. It's a really interesting network of private and civic and university leaders getting behind their special position.
It sounds like EDS and MEDS, as it's been described.
EDS and MEDS, but also, you know, the owner of Quicken Loans, Dan Gilbert, he's purchased about 15 or 16 iconic buildings in the downtown, and he's attracting suburban firms back into the city because what do their employees want? They want walkable, livable, bikeable spaces. You've got that in droves in Philadelphia. You've got great bones in the city.
We also have a very high poverty rate
in
the city. And it's often been described as kind of two cities in one. I think this happens in urban areas like Philadelphia where you have this, you know, young, burgeoning entrepreneurial class, and you got a lot of poor folks.
Well, here's something that I think is really critical in this book. We have to reimagine the American economy, right? What everyone will talk about that's critical to our future, city future, metro future, national future, is STEM, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, right? Economies that have lots of that, power forward. Economies that don't, atrophy. We have about 20% of our economy in STEM. Now, we used to think that we only had about 4 or 5%, and the only people who participated were engineers from Stanford, MIT, and Georgia Tech. Actually, this is an economy that kids coming out of high school with the right technical skills or coming out of community colleges can participate in and prosper. So my sense is post-recession, and you see this in Northeast Ohio, and you see this in other parts of the country, we need to rethink what really matters in our economy. It's not Starbucks and Stadia, right? It's not the consumption economy. It's the production economy, the innovation economy. And let's prepare the kids in the Philly school systems and in your suburban school systems for these really smart, strategic jobs. We can do that.
And that's Bruce Katz, our guest today on Radio Times. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. He's co-author with Jennifer Bradley of a new book. It's titled The Metropolitan Revolution, How Cities and Metros Are Fixing Our Broken Politics and Fragile Economy, basically saying it's time to spend some attention talking about metropolitan areas, homes and sites of innovation and development. Bruce Katz is the director of the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institute. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. What do you think? Give us a call. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Fox Chase offers lung screening for individuals at high risk of lung cancer. Based on results of a national trial which showed death from lung cancer was reduced by 20% with early detection. Qualified candidates receive a low-dose CT scan and an appointment with an advanced practice clinician to discuss the results that same day. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center, now part of Temple Health.
This week in This American Life, woman goes into a casino, plays blackjack, loses a ton of money, and then sues the casino. Which, of course, raises a question.
What? Why is she not liable? It seems like if you go to a casino, that's like, you know what you're doing.
Because at the time of those losses, she has...
Stories about blackjack this week.
No. Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, novelist Kate Christensen. Her memoir, Blue Plate Special, opens with a scary scene at her childhood breakfast table, and an engaging story unfolds about food and emotion. Then health writer Joe Robinson explains why we'd be better off eating a little more like our prehistoric ancestors. Her book is Eating on the Wild Side. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and our guest Bruce Katz says that with the gridlock paralyzing Congress, metropolitan areas like Philadelphia, the surrounding suburbs, can and should take the lead when it comes to things like job creation, economic development, innovation, sustainability, even trade with the rest of the world. And that's what he and his co-author Jennifer Bradley write about in their new book called The Metropolitan Revolution. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Do you see the recession, and we're still sort of working our way out of that, but certainly the collapse and the recession as a wake-up call? And do you think it has woken up the right people?
I think it's a complete wake-up call, because I think the economy we had moving into the recession was one that was really characterized, dominated by consumption and debt. Home building, right? I mean, overextension. What we're shifting to slowly, and we already see signs of this happening, is an economy that's fueled by innovation, ideas, but also manufacturing. We can actually make things in this country, powered by lower carbon and advanced energy. A lot of that's actually happening in this region. Very interesting. Driven by exports and global engagement. 95% of the consumers live outside the United States. They need the products we make, the services we provide. If you actually build that economy, it will be rich with opportunity. We have 107 million people in this country in poverty or near poverty. We only had 80 million back in 2000, right? So we need to create more jobs, better jobs. And we frankly think it's the cities and metro areas, many of which we talk about in the book, that are ones at the vanguard of this. They're the ones really getting behind their manufacturing sector, investing in innovation and skills that are customized to the sectors they have, and engaging in trade.
But where does that money come? I mean, you know, there's austerity here in Philadelphia. There's austerity in Harrisburg, austerity in New Jersey, Delaware, other states as well. The government is trying to figure out how to cut back. Where do you find the funds for this kind of investment?
Well, some of it is using funds we already have, but using them differently, right? I mean, if we take schooling or skilling as an example. There is substantial money in our systems, right? But we bought this notion that somehow we were going to be a post-industrial economy. Maybe we'd generate the ideas in Silicon Valley, but then we'd produce the products in China. Right? That literally is what we were told by our leaders for 20 years. You go down that path in 30 years or 50 years, we will lose our ability to have a social contract in this country. So I think the funding that goes into our schooling system and our skilling systems can be used much better to help people get the skills they need to compete for these jobs in the science, technology, engineering, and math sectors, many of which require either a high school degree or an associate's degree coming out of community college, but with the right technology skills.
But can these people compete with workers in China who are paid so much less and don't have the, you know, the sometimes paltry benefits that are given in this country?
We should remember the assets we have. We have a network of the most advanced research institutions in the world. We are the envy of the world. We have a shale gas revolution underway in the United States. It is radically lowering energy costs. And so when you actually look at the calculus for many companies in the manufacturing sector, they would basically say to you, you know, we offshore too much to China. We should have kept a lot more back in the United States, particularly given our relationship with Mexico and Canada. North America looks like a very powerful competitive platform going forward. And then there's obviously other sectors of the economy where technology is absolutely certain. I mean, almost all globally competitive firms obviously really are technology driven, not just in the manufacturing sector. That's why we need a reset in our thinking about what it takes for a worker to compete in the world. It doesn't just take a 4-year liberal arts degree. For a good portion of our workers, particularly in the inner city or older suburbs, there are examples, proven models of taking kids with fifth grade math and in 4 years in high school, giving them the credentials they can to get a good job and compete.
Where is that being done?
Chicago. I mean, we can go to, I literally could go to many parts of the country. It's not a system change, right? You won't see their entire school system working, what you'll see is a career academy, usually co-run with business. Austin Polytech in Chicago, west side of Chicago, they're a large manufacturing hub for small business. They're doing this. Mm. We know how to replicate innovation in this country. That's what we're really good at. That's what we should get about the business of doing.
But that frustrates me because there are examples, for instance, in this city of
right.
schools that are doing a really good job under difficult circumstances, yet we don't replicate those for whatever reason.
Well, you know, schools are, and education is obviously the biggest challenge. You've made some progress, like many cities, in individual schools, right? We have more competition now in our school systems. I think we have more of an understanding that if there's anything that's going to basically help people lift out of poverty, it's the right kind of education, not just the standardized tests and so forth and teaching to the test, but giving people the skills they need so they can go into the workplace and perform. So that's a little different. I mean, I think we've gone a little too test happy in this country. And, you know, one of the things we talk about in our book, we have a race to the top at the national level around education. I think we need a race to the shop. Remember shop? Remember vocational education? Remember career and technical? I didn't do quite well at this, but there are many people in this country who I think have inherent skills and capacities to participate in a much more substantial way in our economy. We should unleash their potential. It's a different kind of thinking about schools.
And are these the kind of jobs that in the past, the good job in the local factory that actually paid a decent wage?
Very much paid a decent wage. They also, if you go to a factory today, I mean, you know, there are people who still tend to think about manufacturing as Rosie the Riveter. Like somehow we're back in the 1940s. These are technologically sophisticated places. Incredible capital investment. They require a different kind of skilled worker. I've been to many of these factories around the country. It won't solve all of our problems, but it will put us back on a more innovative and resilient path.
Well, and you know, you can hear my pessimism leaking out. I'm trying to get as optimistic as you are. I worry that we are creating industries or even companies that hire 7 people. I worry that we're not creating the kind of industries that will hire all the people that are looking for work or want to get a better job.
Well, we have to think about this as a continuum, right? Because we have to think about the idea generation side, which are in many of our advanced research institutions or in the sort of public-private that you have, for example, in the Navy Yard around energy efficiency. We have to think about people who are skilled at taking research and commercializing it into products and services. And then we have the production jobs. But we have a whole bunch of service jobs related to manufacturing. And then, of course, trade and logistics jobs. Those are good jobs. This is a broader continuum. We've tended to only think about a small portion of it when actually if we had the full supply chain in our mind, we can begin to understand how powerful this is. And the most important thing about the innovative economy, the productive economy, it has a multiplier effect. You know, so when a Walmart comes to a neighborhood, you're just recycling income, essentially. When a manufacturing firm or another innovation firm grows and expands, that creates the kind of income that really has much more dramatic return on investment and return on community.
Well,
big return.
And apparently these kinds of companies are looking to hire people and they cannot find
desperate.
Them.
Desperate. I mean, I go around the country and the one phrase I hear from everyone is give us skilled workers. And okay, maybe in a couple places the community college seems to be working or a high school seems to be focused on a particular sector. There is a desperation out there that we're not educating and skilling our workers for the jobs that actually exist.
And that's Bruce Katz, our guest today on Radio Times, co-author of a new book called The Metropolitan Revolution, How Cities and Metros Are Fixing Our Broken Politics and Fragile Economy. He's vice president and director of the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution in D.C., and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You've gotten a taste of Bruce Katz's optimism and excitement about our future, and we want to hear from you. Let me get Wade to join us. And Wade, go ahead from Northeast Baltimore. Do we have Wade?
related to Baltimore, where I grew up.
Yes.
Yeah, I just wondered if your guests could talk about Baltimore. I mean, I was young in the early 60s when they started the redevelopment of the downtown area. And from what I recall, they created what was called the Greater Baltimore Committee, which was a meshing of private concerns and civic groups that pretty much just, they basically rebuilt the harbor area.
Sure.
Right.
And just seems like from one decade to the next, it just kept on adding on and on and on. And I just wondered if you guys had ever kind of had looked at that progression, examined its benefits and failings, because Baltimore certainly still has its
sure.
slew of problems.
Well, Wade,
and in what way is it the kind of thing that he's speaking of?
I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I guess stadiums and waterfront development,
no,
and that was part of urban
renewal? It was very much part of the urban development that characterized Cleveland and characterized Baltimore. But and if you go there today, what you've seen is there has been a sort of an influx of financial service firms that want to be in this very high quality place. You've got Johns Hopkins, right, in Baltimore. I mean, it is one of the most powerful advanced research institutions. There's the potential, I think, for some incredible innovation districts. University of Maryland is also quite near the downtown. And to a large extent, Baltimore is part of the Washington, D.C. economy. And Washington, D.C. has become one of the most prosperous economies, private economies in the United States because of cybersecurity, because of Life Sciences National Institute of Health, because of information tech. Look, Baltimore as a city is about 600,000 people, very, very, very high poverty rates. But there are certain assets and advantages. As you can tell from the conversation, I think it's this focus on the fundamentals, infrastructure, innovation, education and skills that ultimately are the gifts that keep on giving. You know, making restoring your waterfront important, it needs to be towards a broader purpose, though. It's not just to create sort of a nice place to go visit on a weekend and then go back home.
Do we still need to build stadiums? I mean, that has been seen as an economic draw and giving a city or a region a high profile.
I am not a big fan of subsidizing stadia. I am not a big fan of subsidizing convention center expansions that never really pay off, or even performing arts facilities. You know, we're in a tough fiscal period right now, and I think cities need to make some hard choices. You know, one of the stories in our book is New York City.
Yeah.
New York City put $130 million to attract world-class universities to Roosevelt Island, $2 billion immediate return in private investment, $30 billion expected over 30 years because they brought in Cornell and Technion. They now have a platform for technology-oriented growth for the entire city. It will bring unbelievable benefits. How much does a stadium really build? I mean, mm-hmm. How much beer and hot dogs can you really consume?
Let me see what Patty from Collegeville has to say. And Patty, go ahead. You are on Radio Times.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was wondering, when you discuss manufacturing in this country, and I think that, you know, in this post-industrial revolution, we have gotten away from it a little bit more. The jobs have gone elsewhere. I'm wondering what you think, if you think the fact that most cities particularly are heavily unionized, do you think that this has had some effect on that? And if so, you know, what? I mean, it certainly makes the cost for, employment
sure.
much more expensive.
Patty, thanks for the call. Go ahead.
Frankly, I think the bigger impact is this sort of, you know, general consensus that we were not going to be a platform for production anymore. I mean, the cost differential, obviously, with places like China was a big part of that initially. But over time, it really sunk into our psyche to the point that we didn't quite understand what does it mean to be a productive and innovative economy. You go to Germany today, about twice the share of their GDP is dedicated to manufacturing and production. Why? Because manufacturing jobs are not stigmatized. They have applied research institutes all over that take ideas, yes, ideas are important, but then commercialize them for real products, right? And then they skill their workers. They have apprenticeships. People spend 3 months in a company and then 3 months in a university. There's a completely different thinking about what kind of economy you want to build. We were literally building an economy based on consumption.
We also, in the last couple of years, have heard a lot of anti-union talk that somehow, you know, unions were the problem for rebuilding this economy.
Look, I think unions can be actually essential partners, because when I see unions in different parts of the country that are really playing a central role, they're part of helping workers get the additional skills they need to participate in the evolution of their companies and their sectors. I mean, think about any of us today, right, and what we learned 30 years ago. If we just stopped then, right, we wouldn't be that productive anymore. You've got to constantly learn. Mm-hmm. Unions can be part of that. And so I really think the most important thing for cities and metropolitan areas, federal government, state governments, their governments, right, highly partisan, highly polarized. Cities and metros, networks of leaders, they put place over party, they put collaboration over conflict. They need to think about what kind of economy do we want to build off the base we have to serve the largest number of people. Good jobs, better jobs.
But is this also because those leaders are just closer to the people that they're talking about?
They can't run away from the challenges, right? When you're stuck in traffic, or when you have high unemployment, or you have high poverty, or your schools aren't, you can't run away. You go to Washington, it seems like it's almost a parallel universe.
I do want to get to some callers, but I'm also looking at the clock here. Let me ask you about trade. I mean, whether these city-states, for lack of a better word, or metropolitan areas, sort of should develop their own trade policies with the rest of the world. Well, does that make sense?
Yes, it absolutely does. And this is the reason why. 95% of the consumers live outside the United States. A very small portion of our economy is actually dedicated to exports. Only 13%, right? Every other competitive economy in the world is much, much higher, 15, 20, 30%. We have to trade more with the world. We just can't look inward for our growth. Our example in the book is Portland, Oregon. Yes, weird and crunchy, right? We have Portlandia.
We do.
But they are one of five metropolitan areas that doubled their exports in the middle of the last decade because of computers and electronics. And now, because they're growing in such sustainable ways, environmentally sustainable ways, they've attracted all these firms making sustainable products and services that are now basically selling to China, India, and other rising countries. You know, I mean, there's this bad rap that, you know, what's good for the environment is bad for the economy. Go to Portland. It's the complete opposite story.
But what you're saying is what, they don't need the federal government? They can negotiate all these trade deals on the side, or there is a role for them?
Well, the federal government sort of sets the rules, right? It sets the free trade agreements. Out of the Ex-Im Bank, they provide export promotion finance. Our Department of Commerce abroad helps small companies access global markets, right? Intellectual property, trade enforcement. The federal government does certain things, but the people who actually get on a plane and go to these other countries, they're city and metropolitan leaders.
And that's Bruce Katz, co-author of The Metropolitan Revolution, director of the Metropolitan Policy Program at the Brookings Institution. We're going to talk more after this short break and take some more calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hello, I'm Russell Kaufman, president of the Wistar Institute, a proud supporter of WHYY. For over 100 years, Wistar scientists have helped keep your families, friends, and employees healthy because of our research that guides the creation of early-stage drugs. We then work with the pharmaceutical industry for their final production. Our name may not be on these cancer drugs, but our fingerprints are all over them. To learn more about how Wistar keeps you healthy and our region economically strong, online at wistar.org.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, best-selling author Lionel Shriver mines personal history for her book about morbid obesity.
If it were just my family's problem, I don't know that I would necessarily have made a novel, but in that it's also a larger social problem, I thought it was worth writing about.
That and more next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Creating a democracy for the people, by the people, in a region in turmoil.
We need to create a democratic culture. This is what we need. where people will accept each other.
The long road to democracy in the Middle East and roadblocks along the way. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. And if you're just joining us, he is the co-author of a new book called The Metropolitan Revolution, and it's subtitled How Cities and Metros Are Fixing Our Broken Politics and Fragile Economy, bringing some good news to the radio, something that hasn't happened in quite a while. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. As I was reading your book, I was thinking about, you know, the horrible Hurricane Sandy that did so much devastation along the coast here and certainly in this region as well. And it seems like the first impulse when something like that happens or these terrible fires out west is you call the federal government.
Sure.
And maybe that's the appropriate role for the federal government to come in when there is an emergency.
You know, I think natural disasters is an appropriate role for the federal government. And it's one of the rare times where the federal government actually acts in the service of cities and metropolitan areas. They behave well. They don't come in with these prescriptive and technocratic and bureaucratic solutions. They come in really to help. And you know, I think going forward, we need more of that. We need a humbler national government. Hmm. What we have in the United States, which really puts us, I think, at the forefront of human progress, is representative democracy, right? I mean, just think about the term. And I think that's what happens in a natural disaster. When we don't have a natural disaster, we just have these big, supersized challenges we're trying to deal with, jobs, poverty, innovation. What we have is a national government that tends to be a lot more prescriptive, a lot more difficult to deal with, a lot of rules that just don't seem like they make any sense.
And how much do you think the kind of, unlike Europe, that doesn't seem to have a negative view of cities, how much do you think just the reputation deserved or not for city governments, for city life, how much do you think that hurts this message?
Well, you know, we are an urban and metropolitan nation that for a long time thought we were something else, right? I mean, we have this image of ourselves, small town America, rural America. It hasn't been that way for quite some time. And so what is happening, I think, literally in this century, is we are seeing large numbers of people, particularly the millennials, but also the empty nesters, they're beginning to change their preferences for where they live and the kind of assets and attributes their communities have. Driving is basically not the number one priority of 16-year-olds anymore. Right?
Yeah, they're not buying cars. I mean, they're getting driver's licenses.
They are basically looking at a different set of goods that they want to purchase or places where they want to live. So a lot of what we're describing in our book are big forces that are happening here. Demographic preferences are shifting. And I think over time, we will celebrate the city, but in an American way. I mean, our cities are different than the European cities.
But you also say in this book that the first American Revolution, the one of 200 and some years ago, was an urban revolution.
It was an urban revolution. I was a history major in college, so I have to say this was the most fun I had in the entire book. Because going back to the American Revolution, where we think of these agrarian farmers like George Washington or Thomas Jefferson, and understanding what really propelled our revolution were the urban classes, the mercantile classes, becoming very upset with the prescriptive technocratic rules coming out of Great Britain, and then also organizing themselves as networks, the Sons of Liberty, the fire brigades, so that we could begin to sort of remove ourselves from the yoke. These are amazing stories, and they're urban stories, and we should remember how much of our country is rooted in that.
Let me see what Jose from Burlington County, New Jersey has to say. Jose, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I would tend to think that looking at Europe and its methodology of education and employment and trading and its partnership with its industries and companies is something that we should be emulating. And I think that your speaker has mentioned it time and again in his book. But I think that there's a lot of lessons to be learned there, and it's not like we're conducting brain surgery to find something new.
Well, I'm sorry, Jose. Yes, go ahead.
As a as a social service director here in Burlington County, I see government spending a tremendous amount of money in teaching young children how to write resumes for jobs that really go nowhere.
Mm.
We don't seem to educate, and we don't seem to partner with resources very well, whether they be civic or government or state or federal. It's criminal to me.
Well, Jose, I appreciate the call talking about the compartmentalization, I guess.
I think it's a great comment, and, you know, several things from it. You know, A, we do need to look abroad for best innovations. I mean, we have to look beyond ourselves because, again, we were sort of pursuing a certain kind of growth model in this country and in many of our cities and metros. And now if we want to get back on track, right, that's what we want to do, we could look to Europe for some of the lessons there from production and innovation. Frankly, I was just in a city in Mexico, Querétaro, which is a new aerospace hub. The same kind of European style, let's train workers for technologically sophisticated jobs, is happening there.
Hmm.
We're going to be taking a delegation to Querétaro, Mexico, because we think there are some lessons we could apply back to our high schools and to our community colleges, right? Out of other parts of Latin America, bus rapid transit. I mean, you know, we as Americans, you know, we have unbelievable assets in this country, unbelievable advantages. If we actually take some of the best innovations from around the world and at the city-state level, at the city-metro level, deploy them, apply them, nothing can stop us.
I remember reading about Germany when the recession really hit hard.
Right.
And one of the things it seems that many companies in Germany did, rather than laying people off, is they just cut their hours.
That's right.
And there was less kind of disruption.
Less tumult.
Tumult and less pain, frankly, of people actually losing their employment.
Yeah. We are a tough country in many respects. I mean, we don't have the safety net that exists in many other parts of the world. And we don't have this social contract in many respects. There are benefits from the American model, but there obviously are some huge drawbacks. And again, I will just impress upon the listeners this statistic. In 2000, 80 million Americans were in poverty or near poverty. In 2011, 107 million people.
Mm-hmm.
We have had a quantum leap. And if that's not a wake-up call, I don't know what is. And I don't see the national government ever talking about this. States are adrift. It's really at city and metropolitan levels. They get up every morning and they have to deal with this, whether in social service providers or in, you know, unemployment agencies. We need to go back to some basics. I think the stories in this book are very much about that, but not just government. Business leaders, university leaders, union leaders, environmental leaders. We can all do this. It's not a rocket science.
Let me get back to our callers at 1-888-477-9499. Jose, thanks for the call. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-WHYY. Looks like we have Angela from Southampton joining us on Radio Times. Angela, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
I
was listening to what you were saying about education and highly skilled education to produce the highly skilled technical workers that the industries need. And I work for a school district where we have had, you know, recent multi-million dollar expansions of our technical school that serves our high schools in our suburban area. I mean, these programs are state-of-the-art, and yet we can't draw students into them. They continue to suffer for enrollment. And, you know, while the school district tries to encourage the students to consider that, there still continues to be a disconnect. I don't know if it's a generational disconnect on the part of their parents who still believe that college is the ultimate place for their student. But, you know, many of these students, not only do they get placed in excellent jobs right out of school, but those industries often pay for them to go to college to continue their degree.
Well, Angela,
that disconnect.
But you have to. Bruce Katz is nodding vigorously as you're calling.
Now, this is just a brilliant comment. And it's not surprising to me in some respects, because after 30 years of having it drummed into our heads that we were going to be a post-industrial economy and we're going to be a Facebook economy or a Google economy and manufacturing is dirty and all those things, it's not surprising that you know, children sort of absorb these lessons, right? So in many ways, what we are about to do is re-educate the country about what is a productive and innovative economy and what are the multitude of options we have, and to make these jobs sexy again, right? Because for some group of people in our country, this is the kind of craft, right? We don't even use these words anymore. Trade, right? I mean, we have to go back to some fundamentals. And I think this is a very disruptive, I mean, talk about a revolution, because, you know, revolutions that ultimately are about behavior and how you think about the world. If we think differently about work and the dignity of work and the restoration of craft, we could have millions of people live much more productive and happy lives in our country.
Well, imagine a world without plumbers and electricians. I mean,
that would be the end of my house.
Well, mine as well. I mean, just to underscore what you just said there.
Right. Absolutely. So, we have tended to denigrate whole sets of occupations in this country. When we think about the wages those occupations pay because of the scarcity of skilled workers, we should be thinking very differently about the sort of messages we impart to our children and the messages we impart to the broader society.
Angelo, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Looks like we have Johannes from Mount Airy joining us on Radio Times. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yes. Good morning to everyone. Mr. Katz mentioned academies programs, and I wonder if he might be aware that the academy started in Philadelphia in the late 60s. And this was a model that, in its purest form, had a governing board consisting in four trade areas. This was an industrial time, a time of, you know, traditional industry: electrical and electronics, automotive, healthcare, and business. Each of those programs was managed by agreement with the school district, and curriculum was set by a governing board consisting of industry representatives, union representatives, the school district, of course, the principal and the program manager, which set curricula which were designed to produce two results in each graduate. We started in the most difficult schools, first Edison High School, which in those days had the highest dropout rate and the lowest graduation rate in the city, and proved that we can turn a part of that school around. Each graduate.
Well, you know what, Johannes? Let me take your call because it's a good one, and again, Bruce Katz wants to respond.
And I think it comes back to one of these themes that permeate here, which is the compartmentalization of how we think about our challenges and our opportunities. You know, we leave education to the educators, right? We leave transportation to the transportation experts, where a lot of the solutions to transportation might be housing closer to work, more options, biking, walking, transit. So, no, what you're describing is a different model, right? Is where we have business and civic and philanthropic leaders deeply engaged in the teaching of our children and the skilling of our workers. And the result of that will be better results for our companies, our economies, and frankly, more opportunities for our workers and our children. So the only place where this can happen is in cities and metropolitan areas. The federal government have these agencies, the Department of Education, the Department of Commerce, the Department of Transportation. I don't see them collaborating anytime soon the way you can do this at the local level.
But do we need those departments? I mean, some have called for the end of the Department of Education for a whole host of reasons.
We just need them to have more flexibility and to recognize that the true innovators in this country are the people on the local level, in the suburban areas, in the cities, who are solving these tough challenges. So what we need from Washington is to be in service of our innovation and not be a barrier, and this is a change. I mean, again, that's the revolution here. We are changing how we think about power and leadership. It doesn't sit on top in Washington. It actually sits with our cities and metropolitan areas.
And do you find, I mean, your book looks at four different areas, but do you find what we have been talking about, that is spreading and other areas are beginning to think this way? Because one of my worries would be that you have winners and losers, is that you have some regions that are going to take this on and reap the benefits, and others are not, and people will suffer.
You know, I think generally speaking, every place that I go to in the United States has distinctive assets. They're not the same. I mean, we have to get beyond this notion of, you know, because we live in a Walmart economy, so you go to a place, everyone's got the same, you know, same goods, same services, same design. You know, what makes Phoenix great is different than Philadelphia or Pittsburgh or Detroit or Denver. So we need to find out what's our distinctive role, what's our distinctive advantage, and then build on that, leverage that, exploit that, right? So I actually think, A, this is happening in a lot more places than we talked about in the book. If we talked about all these places, it would have gone on for another 3 years. We had to bring it to a close. But B, I think the potential, the possibility of places now understanding, you know, we're on our own, that could be exhilarating. That could be liberating if we sort of treat this as a moment to understand, you know, who we are. Now, Dolly Parton, great American economist from the 20th century, said, find out who you are and do it on purpose. In a way, that just sums up our entire book, right?
Thank you, Dolly Parton. And Bruce Guest, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. Co-author of this new book we've been talking about called The Metropolitan Revolution, How Cities and Metros Are Fixing Our Broken Politics and Fragile Economy. He's vice president and director of the Metropolitan Policy Program that's at the Brookings Institution in Washington, D.C. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes and you can find out much more about this program. In fact, we put some Facebook pictures on our show today of our guest as we were preparing for this interview. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. Jessica Crocker is our intern. The show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, and Debbie Builder with Sophie Reed. I'm Marty Moscoing. Thank you so much for joining us.